Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Premier, thank you very much for taking the time. And how are you doing? How's the province handling the pandemic and the numbers these days?
We're doing pretty good here, Roy, and thanks for taking some time on Sunday here, and thanks for what you do in communicating with Canadians across this nation with your show. We're doing all right. We're having the localized outbreaks here and there, but we're able to identify them and contact trace them, and thus far we've been able to isolate those in a fairly good fashion. But in general, we're doing pretty good, and that is a credit to the people of this province. They are, for the most part, obeying the public health orders that have been put forward, and that's allowing us to really start to focus in on an economic recovery here in Saskatchewan, and hopefully we can across Canada very shortly.
Yeah, we need it. Boy, do we need it. We spent some time over the last couple of months with the Parliamentary Budget Officer, Yves Giroux, and he said to us twice that what was spent during the first lockdown could be done, but only done once. Premier, looking ahead to Wednesday and the speech from the throne, I'd like to ask you this out of the gate. What can Canada and what can Canadians afford, and what can we not afford as far as any really massive spending announcements in the speech may be concerned?
Well, I would say we can afford a whole lot more, and I agree with the Parliamentary Budget Officer that we have invested heavily, and some of it has been very targeted and effective, and some, I think, could probably use some rethought and some revisions. I would say in the speech from the throne, there's two things that we need to look at. The first is to correct the relationship that has deteriorated over decades between the federal and provincial government. It's the fiscal relationship, and you're going to hear premiers talking about, as Premier Ford was, the Canada Health Transfer, and how that was a 50-50 arrangement a number of years ago. Now we're down to about 22% federal investment. But, you know, there's the flawed equalization formula. There is the little brother to the equalization formula, which is the fiscal stabilization program. All of these need some attention between the provincial and federal government. I think it speaks to the crossroads that this prime minister and this government is at. At this speech, at this date, with the speech of the throne really being the indicator on the direction that they're going to take with the fiscal-provincial relationship and whether or not they want to actually look at correcting that. That's the first piece. The second piece is more to the recovery. We hear this talk around an ambitious green agenda, and I've said in my letter that better not be code for shutting down industries in this nation, in particular the energy industry or the mining industry for that matter, because it would not be an ambitious green agenda. That would actually be a vicious green agenda here in Canada. We need to really look at the industries that have created wealth traditionally in our provinces and in our regions, and we need to look at how we are going to not only maybe support them, but give them some laneway so that they can recover and grow and provide jobs into the future. Let's be clear. There's no government that's going to all of a sudden, in a speech from the throne, invent a whole new green economy. We need to look at the industries that have created wealth and jobs across this nation that are already sustainable, I would put forward, and have many times. And we need to look at how they are going to be successful in the short term and how we strategically are going to situate ourselves so that they can be successful in the longer term. This is the crossroads that the Prime Minister is at, and he has a lot of weight in his shoulders. There's a lot riding on the direction that he's going to take next week.
Well, he's the man who talked about the recovery being significantly driven by a green resurgence. He's the man who has led this position. Have you received any signals about what might be coming down on Wednesday? Have you heard anything that would suggest that traditional economically strong and economy-driving sectors may in fact be disadvantaged by the throne speech?
I think the fact that we had penned a letter indicating some of the concerns that we have around the language around an ambitious green agenda, and that may be quote for shutting down some of these industries, most certainly speaks to the fact that we do have concerns. We do have concerns that there will be you know, regulations that will be leaned in on the speech from the throne, like advancing a clean fuel standard that does disproportionately, again, impact certain industries that seem to be located in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Newfoundland. We do have concerns that as people are being supported in many cases by the federal government. The federal government continues to move forward with ineffective policies that we are actually taking them to the Supreme Court of Canada next week on, which is, you know, the infamous carbon tax, the most ineffective cash grab that this federal government has enacted. As well as if we truly want to, you know, do the right thing with respect to providing emissions-free power, there are other options that the provinces are leading on, such as the small modular reactor option. And we heard Seamus O'Regan make some comments around that's absolutely necessary if we are going to move into a lower carbon environment in the next number of decades. So, you know, let's have those discussions with the federal government and let's get on with it. Let's get rid of the ineffective policies like the carbon tax, the clean fuel standard that is put on in the method that the way that they are implementing it. And let's get on with some of the technologies and innovation that can actually get us to where we want to be.
Premier Moe, let me come back to the question or the issue of the four premiers, west to east, François Legault, Doug Ford, Brian Pallister, Jason Kenney, requesting a combined $70 billion from the Trudeau government to direct toward health care in the provinces. You touched on that. Does Saskatchewan have a similar request for the Trudeau government?
Yeah, the request is coming from the Council of Federation table. So it is supported by all of the premiers, and the you know, two of them are the fiscal stabilization program, which is really a response to a flawed equalization program, and on how we can support jurisdictions in this nation that have experienced a fairly rapid downturn. And Alberta to an extreme level, Saskatchewan and Newfoundland as well have experienced a downturn, predominantly due to two things. One is the energy price, yes, around the world has been somewhat fluctuating and mostly heading down the last number of years. But two is some very alarming policies that have come from the federal government that are nothing short of an attack on this industry. And so the fiscal stabilization program is a fail-safe, I guess, a stopgap that it's supposed to step in those unfortunate times in pretty quick order. It's a flawed program as well, and so they've asked for some changes to that. And ultimately, the health transfer, which is a tremendously important funding agreement between the federal government and the provincial governments, one that began as 50-50 partners a number of decades ago, has slipped over successive governments. There's about 22% is now funded by the federal government. And this needs to be funding that is flexible for the provinces. It can't be a pharmacare program that will be counted as healthcare funding. That's additive. I think Brian Pallister had spoken about having a solid foundation in the home before you start adding on extra levels. So that is absolutely imperative that we have those discussions. Listen, provinces and regions in this country are going to be faced with not only the economic recovery, but how do we recover on some of the surgery backlogs and the diagnostic backlogs that we have across this nation post-COVID, as COVID has impacted what's happening in our hospitals. So there's going to have to be that discussion with the federal government on the Canada Health Transfer. And in fairness, the Prime Minister has indicated, this is one indication that we have had, is he does want to have a First Minister's meeting on the Canada Health Transfer exclusively this fall, and we look forward to that.
Let me ask you this. Is there communication between premiers about a possible second national lockdown? And if so, are contingencies in place to protect an already significantly damaged provincial and national economy or economies from being exponentially harmed?
So there's no discussion among provinces or premiers on any type of a national lockdown. And let me speak to Saskatchewan's perspective on this. We're going to do everything in our power, and I would say that we are not going to have any type of a lockdown here in this province that will negatively impact our economy as we move forward. We have learned much about this virus. We have also learned much about the impact this virus has had and the response to this virus has had on our economic fortunes. And I truly believe that as we move forward through whatever the time period is left until we can find a vaccine or whatever it is that finds us out the other side of this COVID-19 pandemic, that we understand the virus well enough that we will not be required to lock down wide swaths of our economic generating industries, at least in Saskatchewan. We are committed to that. We feel that there are other ways that we can control the spread of COVID-19. And I think most provincial premiers across the nation are, I won't speak for them, but I think most of them are of close to that mindset.
I mean, we know how much stress there is. Just talk to Dan Kelly, which we'll do later, of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. And Mr. Kelly has told us that up to 225,000 businesses, small businesses in this country, could be in serious trouble. 155,000, really close to not making it. And that's, they're the number one employer in Canada. So we have to protect our economy, because without the economy, we have very little. And that brings us back to the throne speech and the component requirements there. This is a huge picture. We don't know where it's going, do we, Premier? But we have to be smart about how we deal with resurrecting our economy and protecting it.
We absolutely do. And we need to focus on, because we have already responded financially in a large way at the federal level, we don't have a lot of fiscal capacity left to respond. Listen, the deficit this year is going to be 25% larger than the last deficit, not the last deficit, the last budget that the previous government introduced, that Stephen Harper introduced in 2015. Our deficit this year is 25% larger than that entire budget. So we don't have a lot of fiscal room left over the course of the next, 10 to 15 months. We need, the investments that we make from here on need to be outcomes-based, and they need to focus on the export-based economy that we have in this nation. If our export industries do well, our retail industries across this nation will also do well, as they rely on servicing, in many cases, the export-based economy that we have. If we're going to focus in this throne speech on how do we recover that export-based economy, we will be taking a great step forward in this nation. If we're going to focus on how do we transition things like CERB to basic incomes, that actually reminds me of the song you had when we first came in here. I think it was back in the USSR.
Back in the USSR.
Illusion. But, if we're looking at standardizing the basic income in this nation rather than how we are trying to attract investment and create a private sector employment for people, we are taking a step backwards. And that is the crossroads that this prime minister is at. Now, let's remember, he's in a minority government situation. And I think it's incumbent on other leaders, myself included, as well as Canadians in general, all 30 plus million of us, all represented by somebody that is part of a minority government party. And we'll be watching very closely how the opposition parties will be voting, what they will be saying with respect to the speech from the throne, and whether they'll ultimately pass it. Because Canadians are in a very powerful situation in this minority parliament.
We spoke with the parliamentary budget officer about the idea of a guaranteed annual income, and he pointed out that his office has done some costing. And the cost would be between 45 and $91 billion for 6 months.
With no real outcomes with respect to creating jobs, with respect to expanding our GDP, expanding our economy in this nation. So, if those are the steps that this federal government is taking, that is a step backwards. That will be something that Saskatchewan will vigorously oppose, and I think it's something that all Canadians should have a real look at where that places us over the course of the next 5-10 years in this nation, and what type of a nation we actually want to leave to our children. It would be extremely disappointing if the Prime Minister and the federal government starts to take steps that direction.
Premier, do you have a sense of whether this speech from the throne has the potential to lead to a federal election before the end of the calendar year? And what would your thoughts be about that? You have an election coming up in Saskatchewan. There was just one in New Brunswick. We'll be speaking with Premier Higgs shortly. What is your sense about the potential for the speech from the throne leading to an election before the end of 2020?
Well, I don't know if it will or if it won't. I think everybody hopes that it wouldn't, and it's on the governing party, the federal Liberals, Prime Minister Trudeau and his colleagues, to put forward a speech from the throne that is not only satisfactory to the majority of Canadians, but is also one that is satisfactory to the majority of the people in the parties in the House that are elected by Canadians. We go back to the federal election. We had a very divisive election. We have a separatist party in Quebec that is gaining ground. We have all sorts of separatist sentiments in the province where I live and neighboring Alberta. And this is due to the policies that this prime minister and this government had brought forward over the first term of their government. And so, I truly hope that we won't have an election, but that is the responsibility of the prime minister to bring forward a throne speech that will not trigger that.
A lot of speculation about the possibility of a federal election before the end of the year, and a lot of talk about what that might be like in the middle of a pandemic. How did you find running an election campaign was like?
Well, it was certainly different. I mean, we didn't do door-to-door campaigning. We limited our activities, and we followed the rules of public health, and certainly we didn't have any difficulty in that regard, although numbers were down. You know, you'd have a reception, and if you had 50 people or 80 or people outside, then it was a big event. And, on the night of the election, we had an event, and we probably had 60 people in a great big hall. So very different, but it can be done, and we felt we were at a safe time to do it, just as we're doing a lot of things in COVID. You know, we can't just sit and wait for a vaccine. We have to get on with life and just do it differently.
Would you share with us, please, what it is you're doing in New Brunswick and what's been done in Atlantic Canada? Because you have the multi-province bubble, but how have you been conducting the pandemic business?
Well, certainly, you know, we've been very conscious in our businesses and with public health from the beginning. We did shut down early, as you know, but we certainly don't want to get back to that. Businesses are paying attention with customers and showing that, you know, masks are being worn if needed, or if they social distance. The school startup's been good, so far so good. And although there are some angst there about different startups, but parents, you know, and teachers both accepted it's time to move on. I think that, you know, we do have a different scenario here than places with big cities. I mean, we're fortunate in that sense. Our city sizes are smaller, and we have wide open spaces here that helps us to do the social distancing and find ways to isolate in ways that meet the health standards. So borders have been secured. You know, we have great people working on our borders and great health officials that are in health, people in the health world that have been really following the protocols. So far, so good. But we're in it, and we know it can change quickly, and we cannot lose sight of paying attention through this until we get a vaccine.
Premier, Wednesday will be the speech from the throne delivered by the Trudeau government, a minority government in Ottawa. What can Canada, and we know the economic situation we're in to a certain extent, we have this massive deficit, we have a huge national debt, our credit rating has been downgraded, we can't really afford or can't count on interest rates remaining as low as they are, but which leads me to this question, what can Canada afford and what can Canada not afford as far as any really massive spending announcements in the speech may be concerned?
Well, it is very much a concern, you know, and during our discussions with all the premiers and the prime minister through the first part of the COVID and 6 months of our situation, the pandemic, we basically, you know, my question often was, what about next year? Because there could be a second wave, and we have to be cognizant of that, and and we've all been appreciative of the help that the federal government has given, but there has to be a limit here through this, because, you know, I unfortunately, we're a province that has been dependent on the transfers. We're focused very much on the Canada health transfer, and I know that all premiers are, because that is a big concern. But my biggest concern I get when I travel around our province, and obviously I just did it for the last 28 days, they can't find people to work. You know, we can't get people to go to work. So there has to be, the throne speech has to reflect that, you know, there's a need to have people work in order to contribute to our province and to provide a contribution that is meaningful to other businesses and people that want to invest private money. We have to stop relying on taxpayer dollars as governments and start pushing more towards, private sector investment that creates employment, entrepreneurs that want to develop in the regions and become more receptive to that. I'm very concerned that we keep going down this trail of a guaranteed income. And what does that do? Because every location around the province, people are saying, I can't get people to work.
Would you just speak a little more to that? When you say you can't get people to work, what are you telling us?
Well, in the sense of, you know, and it was needed. I know when all the businesses were shutting down, and as I say, I was thankful, too, that the federal government kicked in and helped us, people that were losing their jobs because things were changing quickly. But now they're trying to start back up, and, And I'm seeing New Brunswick, you know, it's moving along quickly. And so whether it be in any sort of plant, you know, whether it's food processing, whether it's in the agricultural field, it's people that are, you know, currently getting let's say, on CERB, really say, well, when this is over, I'll come back to work. Well, you know, it's kind of like we have to transition off of the CERB program and into the workforce. And we need the federal government to start focusing on that. Temporary foreign workers, more flexibility in relation to people coming and staying here in our province, as opposed to working 2 months at a job and then going back. We want to bring families. We want to have more security around that and flexibility, which I believe the federal government is looking at, and we're working closely with them on that. But it is a time now to transition, not the fact that we're out of COVID, but to transition to life with COVID, but to an economy that is once again being promoted and funded by private sector investment and not ignoring our resources that we have. I mean, we've been strong because of our natural resources. And I've said for a long time that transition is, as we transition to different economies, we do that in a way that we don't lose sight of what's funded us for many generations. But we work through a process here, not just shut the switch off and kind of hope for the best.
Now, the Parliamentary Budget Officer has been on this program twice over the last few weeks. And Mr. Giroux pointed out that we could afford, quotation marks around afford, even though when I ran the numbers by him, which he knew better than I, he said just hearing them from somebody else made his head spin. But he said we could do this once, not twice. You know, the CERB and the other programs that we had. We can do it once. We cannot do it twice. So are you worried? Do you have concern about what's going to come out of Ottawa in that throne speech on Wednesday? Maybe a guaranteed annual income, which, again, the Parliamentary Budget Officer told us would cost between $45 and $91 billion for 6 months. Do you have concerns about that? Maybe traditional industries being shoved aside?
Yes, I do. I definitely have concerns about that. I think we need to have a long, hard discussion of how that works and how that can be fundable for the long haul, and what that does to companies that are looking for full-time employment. I am concerned with that, and I think that CERB has given us what we've seen, is we needed that, but we see now that there's a need to change in how we get people back to work. So I think there's a lot of discussion got to be held, and I am very concerned. We were in good shape on the budget when COVID hit. I mean, we have run into surplus. We were paying down our debt. I mean, we do have a significant debt, but we'd started paying it down. So we had a little cushion there that helped us because we had about a $600 million swing in our revenue. So we need to build that back. We can't keep digging the hole deeper, and we can't charge more taxes. I mean, New Brunswick is such as a high tax province, so I've committed no new taxes. So we have to prepare for the second wave because we can't go back the way we were. So let's not keep digging a hole. Let's start to recover here across this country. And what I saw during COVID is an unprecedented working relationship with all the premiers and the prime minister's office and the prime minister and certainly Mr. Freeland, who was involved in all these discussions. And it went very well. I saw the first time a national pride in how we were managing together and working together. We need to do that on the recovery. So we're all on a page here that is getting our country back, because right now I'm concerned federally how we're going to keep the ship afloat.
Which brings me to something I need to ask you. 2 years ago, around Christmas time, you said on this radio program, you were talking to me, and you said, and this was after the first minister's meeting, you said, we have to decide whether Canada is a nation or an ocean.
Mm-hmm. I did say that, and I feel, well, yes, I do, and I still think it is much of a concern. I think, you know, sometimes people will, when you get into a crisis, like we did with this pandemic, a health crisis, you kind of refocus. You start paying attention to what's really important. So I think we can springboard off of that, and we can say, okay, we worked together on this, and we worked as a nation. And I saw that in that sense during the pandemic, and it was encouraging. So now let's do that as we go forward with other items. And the economic recovery is getting ready for the next wave. Our health issues, which is across the country, but having an economic prosperity in our country like we have had for generations, how do we get back to that? So it shouldn't be that difficult to lay out the economics of it all and say, can we actually go down one road or another? Or is this wishful thinking, political wishful thinking? And I think what we learned through COVID is we can find ways to work together and have a prosperous future thinking as opposed to just a political thinking. And that's what's needed right now. And I was encouraged by the COVID cooperative spirit. And I'd like to think we can carry that going and our nation can be better for it.
If, final question for you, Premier Higgs, if that cooperative spirit disappears after Wednesday, are we capable of holding and running a national election during the pandemic before the end of the year?
I would be surprised if there's a federal election before the end of the year. Are we capable? Yes. But in the big cities, you know, we're seeing in a number of provinces, there's still some serious COVID cases. You know, I wasn't experiencing that here in New Brunswick. And in the smaller provinces, you know, we can work through that. To have a national campaign, I would be surprised if the federal government would exercise that this fall. I would think that that'll happen later, maybe next spring, depending where our situation is. Because it would be, you've got to pay attention. And, you know, we're still going through the 14-day period after the election. But we feel we will be fine. But that doesn't mean there'll be some care area. So I just think that probably a federal election would be a little premature this fall.
When we get behind the businesses, the entrepreneurs who live in our communities, who deliver every day, who sponsor the kids' baseball teams or hockey teams, who are there as part of our mosaic, we're really helping not only the community, but eventually we help the country.
It's a huge, huge deal, and it's one of the reasons why we're so glad to have customers starting to come back to small and medium-sized companies. So many of them have really, you know, were forced to close their doors, really had no option to earn an income. But the jobs they create, the contributions they make to the local community, the tax dollars that they pay that provide the services for all of us, these are just some of the contributions that small and medium-sized business owners make across the country. That doesn't happen to anywhere close to that degree when we're buying things on Amazon.
Yeah. And the CFIB, you pointed out that I think it was up to 225,000 businesses are under stress, 155,000 under more stress, and 55,000, that number 55,000 being potentially going out of business goes back to, I think, July. What are the priorities, knowing all of this, knowing where we are, knowing that the pain still exists in the small business community, fewer customers, lower spending, what are the priorities, the key priorities that you have for the throne speech?
We've got, our eyes are definitely turned to Ottawa this week to make sure that we can clean up some of the support programs that are there for small business. We've got to make sure that programs like CEBA and the rent support program are delivering for more businesses. And still there are, as we've discussed many times, there are some huge, huge gaps in those programs themselves. But our main message to Ottawa is let's not make this worse. We know and accept that there's going to be a giant deficit right now. And in fact, you know, my organization itself is calling for government to come to the help of, to come to the aid of small and medium-sized companies and people across the country. That's going to cost us money, put more dollars on deficits and leading to long-term debt. But goodness, we can't afford to have non-COVID permanent new spending decisions added to the mix at this time. COVID's not over. And if we start embarking upon a whole host of new green energy programs or a whole host of new social programs at this very vulnerable time, you can imagine just how difficult it's going to be to unbury ourselves from some of these challenges. I worry particularly about employment insurance. Government's already made a bunch of temporary changes that I think make some sense to respond to a pandemic. But if they're converted to permanent changes, not only are the costs of those going to be giant for the future, but it can change Canada's work ethic. Roy, there was a change made that you can work as little as 130 hours and receive $400 a week for a half a year. $400 a week if you work 130 hours over the past year. I understand why we have to be careful and allow people to have an income during the pandemic, but imagine if that were a permanent policy change, that somebody that could work 3 hours a week for a year could then get a $400 benefit for 6 months if they don't work. Those are the kinds of things that I worry could become permanent policy before the end of this.
Well, and rightly so, Dan. Numbers like that are only detrimental to the realities that we face. We just spoke with Premier Higgs of New Brunswick, and he said employers are having trouble getting people to go to work.
Yeah.
And very simply, he said, and I asked him about it after he made the statement, I asked him about it again, and he said, we're having trouble getting people to go to work. And a program like that, that Mr. Trudeau, I'm not going to ask you to say this, but I'm going to say it, is an election, which let's get people to vote for us because we're going to give them money. A program like that's only going to hurt.
Well, look, and we know that during the pandemic that there are some gaps, some challenges that are going to be presented.
Of course.
Short term. When the government responded by issuing CERB, it did create problems. Now they're converting that into EI changes. So to a certain extent, we're going to have to grit our teeth and bear that, even as employers, and we struggle to bring people back because people are not just afraid, not just getting more money in some instances from government than working, but we've also spent, a number of months telling them not to leave their home, save as a weekly trip to the grocery store. So to a certain extent, that's understandable. Where I think we need to draw the line as Canadians, though, is if we say, okay, our experience during the pandemic is going to cause us to make these permanent policy changes, that, to me, is the step too far. And what I really worry about could be added through the throne speech. So I'm hoping against hope that that's not. I will say, listening to the media reports, the Fed seemed to be scaling back some of the giant lavish spending programs that they had rumored only a few short weeks ago. I'm hoping that that will be good news and that there'll be moderation used in the throne speech. But there are some real worries. I'll remind your listeners that Canada pension plan premiums are already on a 7-year, we're already 2 years into a 7-year increase in Canada pension plan premiums. Yes, there'll be eventual increases in benefits for some 40 years from now, but the premium increases are starting right now. I don't know too many people that can afford a cut in their paycheck, or for an employer, a cut in their overall payroll budgets in order to pay for another CPP increase that's starting on January 1st. So we're asking the government to put that on ice. There's a carbon tax increase, federal carbon tax increase expected in the spring of next year. That, in my mind, should also be put on hold until we get through the pandemic. Let's not make this worse.
How many small businesses in this country? Is there a number? I'm going to go back to what we said earlier. 155, 225, I've heard those numbers from the CFIB. Is there a number of small businesses that are on the edge?
Yeah, that is the number on the edge. We've got, across Canada, 1.1 million employers, businesses that employ other people. If you add to it the self-employed, there's another 2.5 million altogether. And we estimate somewhere in the range of 55 to 225,000 businesses will be taken out exclusively due to COVID-19 as a result of the first wave. If we add to that a second wave of COVID outbreak, and remember, we've already seen in some provinces like British Columbia, more businesses being shut down again. If that happens, those numbers are going to look like a lowball estimate of the numbers that aren't going to make it. And with every one of those employers, you can imagine how many jobs are going to be affected. That could be 1.5 million jobs that disappear from Canada on a permanent basis if we're not careful. And of course, on top of that, there are very few employers that are actually right now creating new, very few entrepreneurs that are saying, hey, this is a great time to start a new business. So we're not getting the business pickup that we need. Often a business closure is met with then a rebound and another business coming in behind it. I'm not sensing that there's a whole bunch of those right now, Roy.
And I was looking at some of the releases from CFIB.ca, and what I saw repeatedly was fewer customers, lower spending, consistent across Canada.
You're absolutely right. Only 28% of employers have sales back to normal levels, 28%.
Wow.
And I think I really worry about some of the hospitality industry as the weather starts to change. It's colder right now where I am. People are less often going to be sitting out on patios in the restaurant, leaving perhaps open air shopping destinations where they're walking around. So we can imagine as winter sets in, there are going to be a whole bunch of businesses that are going to struggle even more so. Tourism, I mean, there have been Canadians, thank goodness, taking vacations within the country right now. But are we going to be doing that when people are used to a winter holiday? Are they going to be lining up to take a winter holiday in Canada, perhaps to the same number? So that again will take some businesses out. I think as we go through the fall, yes, there are going to be some businesses recovering, and that's a good thing. But many, many others are going to have additional struggles on top of everything else.
We've spoken over the last number of weeks with Mr. Greg Parris. His daughter, Caitlin, was one of five young people who were killed by Matthew DeGroot in Calgary in 2014. And we spoke about the Alberta Review Board, and Mr. Parris and the families have appeared before the Review Board annually, which is the process as the boards decide in each province what they're going to do as far as individuals who are declared not criminally responsible, or NCR, of the acts, the criminal acts, they otherwise would be committed of committing. They move from the criminal justice to the health system because it's decided they have mental health issues, and so they are no longer in the criminal system, and they're not going to be convicted of anything. And they can be released at any time without any restrictions whatsoever on an annual basis. And it's happened. You heard Carol Dedele with Mr. Parris on this program twice. So this past Tuesday, the Alberta Review Board reconvened, and Mr. Parris was there with other family. And one of the most abhorrent things is how families are treated generically by the Canadian justice system. And you heard Mr. Parris tell us last time we talked that the victim's impact statement that he delivered, his family delivered, was redacted by the justice system, which is outrageous. Greg, thank you very much for coming back on the program. I hesitate to ask, but this past Tuesday, you heard something that you haven't heard before, and that is some acknowledgement of the suffering, some acknowledgement of the need to properly respect the five young people who were killed by DeGroot. And you heard the Alberta Review Board take responsibility, I think, or take action that other review boards in this country have not done.
Yes, thanks, Roy. As I said to you last week, I had some hope based on the review on the 8th that that certain privileges that had been granted last year in 2019 would be revoked, and they actually were revoked. So very pleased that we have a small positive glimmer of hope in slowing down the reintegration of Matthew DeGroot into the community.
How did they change his reality, and how did they explain what they were doing? Because the focus generally has been on moving the individual forward and out.
I think they just took, I think it's quite significant that they had four new board members that had been appointed by the then Justice Minister Doug Schweitzer here in Alberta. I think there was a change of viewpoints brought to the board. And there was a sense of logic, I think, and common sense applied to the evidence that had been presented to them on September 8th. And they recognized a real need to exercise some caution related to the evidence and to the risk that Matthew DeGroot portrays to the community at this point.
It's interesting that while they were doing this, prior to the decision that they took, they still redacted your victim's impact statement.
Yeah, and that was noted by pretty much all of the parents, you know, from the five families. Each one of us, in turn, made a comment during our victim impact statement to the level of redaction that goes on. And you know, we're only really able to talk about the impact to us. Obviously, it's been tremendous, and, you know, you don't want to repeat yourself year in and year out when they have the same victim impact statement. But the second we make any commentary as to, you know, what should happen to him, that gets redacted. We're only allowed to talk about the impact on ourselves.
Greg, I was thinking earlier this morning when I was writing some notes about our conversation for myself, and what's happening in Alberta, what you and the other families are accomplishing, and what we heard on Tuesday has national implication, because NCR appeals are being entered more frequently, including by the individual charged with the murders in Atlantic Canada, including two police officers. It's become more, again, it's become repeated more that NCR is being claimed. So I think what's happened on Tuesday may impact that trend.
Well, I hope that's the case. I mean, in the five reviews that we've been part of, there's never been any sort of backtracking by the board. There's always just been acceleration in terms of the privileges provided. But the fact that they revoked every privilege that involves unsupervised access to the community that had been granted last year, I think is, I hope, ground setting, and I hope it does help other cases and other families in other parts of the country, because I've noticed as well that, you know, since the law changes and makes it more difficult to keep NCR patients locked up longer, there's more and more people, including another case in Alberta that just occurred, where you can see that NCR is going to be the defense that's presented, because you definitely get out quicker in that system than you do the penal system at this point in our country.
Yeah. The issue, one of the issues of great concern that you spoke about and Carol spoke about, was that in DeGroote's case, you heard clearly from medical experts that if the treatment were to stop working, or if he were to get off treatment, he would devolve and it would turn into a potentially catastrophic reality for the community that he's in.
Yes, and you know, I take some solace that the board mentioned that at least two or three times in their current disposition, outlining that anyone that be caught in his sphere of paranoia and hallucination would be ultimately a victim. And, you know, they've used the word severe and catastrophic, and there'd be multiple casualties.
Let's talk about something that's really, I know, very close to you and the families and close to the people of Calgary, and is going to be a tremendous tribute to all five of your children. And that is the Quintera Legacy Garden, and we'll tell people how they can contribute and help as far as that's concerned. But tell our listeners across the country, please, what you've done and what awaits.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. This came together almost 4 years ago now with an idea that was brought forward to us by a wonderful individual. And basically, it's a garden to give back to the community of Calgary that's been so supportive of ourselves. And really, it's a musical garden with dedicated performance space, much like the Sharon Lois and Brown Music Garden that some people in Toronto are aware of, but, you know, on probably a grander scale. So we're trying to give back to the community and at the same time provide a legacy for our kids. Our five kids were all friends for a reason. They had a love of the arts, including dance, music, and art. And they had a real strong orientation and love and concern for their community. So all of that came together and became Quintera Legacy Garden. And, you know, it's become a relatively large part of the healing process for all the families involved here, and a real positive place of energy, and we're hoping that for Calgarians and visitors alike, they can come and enjoy the space, whether they're experiencing grief or loss or looking for some sense of peace or comfort or tranquility. But at the same time, we're looking for it to be a place, even more importantly, a place of celebration, a place for music and performance and community connection.
And Greg, when does it open?
Well, construction is almost complete, Roy, and the garden should unofficially open in the next week or two when the fences will come down. And we're looking forward to, sometime next spring with the COVID restrictions hopefully being lifted, that we can have an incredible, wonderful opening event.
Well, that's marvelous, and it is a wonderful tribute. I've looked at, and you can find it online, everyone. It's QuinteraLegacyGarden.com, and that's Quinteraa, so QuinteraLegacyGarden.com, and you can make a contribution as well to the creation of the garden. Greg, thank you so much for spending time with us. I know that it's extremely difficult, and this is a huge issue for everybody in this country, because unfortunately and sadly, you never know who's going to be next affected.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.